Welcome to the Hacktivist Podcast, conversations that matter.
And welcome to another episode of the Hacktivist Podcast. Today I'm joined by Ejeri, and as usual, my name is Michael. And true to what we've been, the conversations we've been having, we want to speak to Ejeri and ask him about, you know, growing up in Ghana and his labels, his philosophy, what he thinks about humanism, what he thinks about the other labels that comes with humanism. So Ejeri, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. I'm grateful. Thanks for having me.
So for those who are not aware, Ejeri is a friend of mine. And as I said, I'll be speaking to friends, allies, and people in the community, in the activism community, and to try and get as much of our stories out there as possible. So, Ejeri, let's start with growing up.
Well, growing up, I come from a family of five boys, single mom.
Wow.
Yeah. My mom took care of us, all of us, growing up there. But our firstborn grew up with his dad. Mm-hmm. So he lived there a couple of years. But my mom took care of us. We never had a dad or any semblance of one. So my mom is all we knew. Five boys, you can imagine how tough she had to be.
Yeah, sounds like a ruckus in the house.
At a point in life, actually, I actually thought my mom was God, because looking at, so that took me to, the black woman is God.
Yeah.
So five boys, primary school, somewhere in Amadina, Thomas Hood Memorial,
Okay. Straight
to Calvary for JHS, Calvary International in Medina, and then through the Cedar College, of course, uni. Legon, haven't done anything else since, but yeah, just self-development.
Okay, so let's look at primary school, right? First, let's look at the five boys in the household, because I'm fascinated by it.
Five, but my eldest lived with his dad.
Okay.
So let's say four.
So you have four boys at home, living with a single mom. Now, what was the balancing act like? And were you the youngest, in the middle somewhere?
I was the youngest for a pretty long time until my kid brother came through.
Okay.
I kind of hated him initially, but yeah. It was tough because my mom didn't have a stable job.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually into construction. She started from sand and stones those days, that I was referred to. So they go on site, they help the people work out and they get money, and then she graduated and then started supplying. So that's how she was making. At the point, it was really good, you know, construction. She was getting government jobs and all of that. So it was pretty good. Sometimes it was pretty bad. But because we realized it wasn't a 9-to-5 job, we acclimatized. When we got something, we saved. So that taught me how to save and then be self-sustained over the period. Because my mom could go out. I mean, not go out as in chilling, but she could go out, because of the nature of her job, go out for a couple of days before she came. Yeah, so growing up, we were taught to be self-sustained, cook for ourselves, even though I can't cook for myself, but I can cook what I like. Cook for ourselves, feed ourselves, take care of ourselves. Yeah, it started from then. And then also take care of women, because we didn't have women in our lives, in terms of sisters and all. Throughout, between myself and my brothers, looking at what my mom was going through, we learned to respect women a lot and treat them well. So every time we have a woman around us, we have to. It's kind of in us to treat her well, or at least put in effort to treat her well. So my love for women started from my mom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how was the relationship with you and your siblings like, given that it was just you and then your mom?
What do you think?
Terrible
and awesome. At a point in time, I actually pulled a knife on my eldest brother, Evans. He also attended at the Cedar College.
Okay.
I pulled a knife on him because I don't know what I did. but he would have beaten me to pulp. So I pulled a knife on him, scared him till he moved to the compound and locked the main gate.
Wow.
So he couldn't enter the main house until my mom came. And luckily she came. And then, you know, I was the last born then, so yeah, she resolved the issue. But it was tough. Mm-hmm. But it was great also because, yeah, you have brothers, so you get to learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You have brothers, some pretty bad and all of that, some pretty good, so you get to learn a lot. So it was.
I get that dynamic. Then again, some will ask, without a man in the house, without a male figure, you think mom was sufficiently providing that balance?
Well, my mom, she's human also, so, you know, at the point in time, she'd be dating. So, and until my kid brother came, my mom was dating this man, his name is Emmanuel, virtually living together.
Mm-hmm.
So he was kind of like a father figure to me. I respect that man a lot. Yes, he taught me a lot, amazing, because he had experience living in Europe. So when he came down, he moved in with us. And then the things he taught us, how to be self-sufficient, the fact that we need to learn to prove ourselves in school, I got that from him.
Okay.
Every time when we came back from school, stick to your books. We never went out. So we are learning. My mom was even pissed at the point in time, insulting us that those in uni, because we're in primary, those in uni are even out enjoying eating, but we are just at home. Yes. So I got that at work, book ethic from my, and it wasn't the same dad.
Yeah.
So I got that book ethic from my kid brother's dad, because he lived with us over a period, and taught us those things. So at a point in time, we had a father figure, but not perpetually.
Yeah.
It was
abrupt.
Yes, abrupt.
Okay, so moving on to, again, I want to explore your childhood a bit more. Primary school, were there any teachers that stood out to you that up till now you still think about them?
It's amazing you ask. There is this teacher. He was gay, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, he was. He moved on a colleague of mine, a pretty close friend of mine. And as dumb as we were as kids, we decided to confront him.
Oh.
Confront him and put him out there, because most people didn't know he was gay, even though some suspected. But he was also trying to pick a move on my... I was a smart kid in school when I was in primary. I was a smart kid, so most of the teachers liked me, even though I was also stubborn. I was a smart kid, so I was kind of close to the teachers, and he was kind of also close to me because he taught my brother also. So he became close, he met my folks, he met my mom, he met her sister, and then tried to move on her.
Your sister?
My mom's sister, my auntie.
Okay.
My direct auntie. So at a point, even my auntie was with us, he came to pick her out. And then the issue about him being gay came out. Not like came out, but came out amongst us.
Yeah.
So my auntie was asking, what do I think? I asked her to make her own decision. Because by then, I thought gay people were devils and people who were non-human, so didn't respect humanity for that matter. So I had great relationship with the teachers, and some of the teachers also, yes, this also comes in. Some of them abused the girls in the class. Abused, not as in forcefully, but they were kids, so they abused. They coerced them, touching them, asking them to come home, and all. We suspected they were actually having sex with them.
Yeah.
So because of that, we hated some of the teachers, and they took it back on us, caning us unnecessarily and all of that. So I was a smart kid, I was a bad boy, I was a rebel also because of these things. I hated some of the teachers who picked on the girls and all of that. So that was the kind of personality I had growing up in primary and JHS. I was a popular kid because I was smart, and I was a bad kid also.
Yeah.
I played basketball and all of that. I had a couple of friends in other schools who came around, so I was a popular kid, smart, kind of well. And then, yeah, kind of a rebel because I tried to fight what I thought was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Interestingly enough, this is not unique then in most Ghanaian primary schools where, because I have also the same experience where there are teachers that we even warn the girls not to go near. Yeah, because yes, they as young as 9 years, 10 years, these teachers were basically predators, like they were pedophiles basically.
That's the word, pedophiles.
And they were teachers. So as young as, because this was in class 6, so class 6 is what, 9, 10?
Yeah, 9, 10, yeah, or so 10, 11.
10, 11. So that's how young the girls in our class were, and the teachers were taking, you know, extra, they used to call it extra classes, because we have extra classes, and then they'll ask the girls, one or two of the girls to stay behind.
So even take their books ahead of them.
Yes.
Or leave their bags with them. They would leave and then ask them to bring it. You know, there were no mobile phones and also they worked with direct messaging.
Yeah.
It was terrible in our school. It was. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, for us, you may say some of it was because I was kind of bad also. Mm-hmm. We wanted the ladies for ourselves. As little as
remember,
we were.
Yeah.
And these teachers with their money, with their ability to coerce them with marks and grades and all of that. They had a competitive edge against us, so we hated them for that.
We didn't really see it as pedophilia then, did we?
Yeah
we just thought it was
competitive.
It was
like,
yeah, it's like, oh, you are just encroaching on our
territory.
You are taking our girls away from us.
Because in our eyes, the girls were ripe. Because
yes.
we were at the same age
with them. So to
ripe,
us, yeah.
Comprehended.
Yeah. But then in retrospect, like, I think maybe in senior high, after senior high, when we were a bit more mature, and we looked back on life in junior high and in primary school, we realized that a lot of the teachers were just preying on the boys and girls, and it was just horrible. And I hope things have changed. A teacher I looked up to very much, a teacher for whom I credit my love for poetry, was a pedophile. I don't know whether he's alive or not.
Preying on boys or girls?
On girls. And so I look back and then I sometimes think, wow, this man was inspirational. At the same time, this was what he was doing. And I don't know how to cancel him from my life. But then again, I look back at the things that I know he has done. Because I was a smart kid, so I sometimes, I do my homework in school, I don't do my homework at home. So I'll stay behind in the other classrooms, and then that some of the things I've changed on, I look back and then I think I really need therapy for the things I have seen. So, I don't know.
And the challenge also, the very popular one was those who preyed on the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in time, if someone preys on a guy, we didn't treat it with, I mean, we saw it as more serious.
Yes.
I mean, you're preying on it. I mean, who does that?
Exactly.
Who does that?
Exactly.
But those, because then again, heterosexuality is so cool.
It's normal. So
once you are preying on a little girl or a schoolgirl,
it's normal. Yeah. I mean, the teacher I speak of retired as a teacher, like he didn't lose his job or anything, and I'm sure he didn't stop at my batch, and he didn't start with my batch. We were going into class 6, there were already rumors that this is what he does, and even when we were leaving, he was still up to his tricks. So he probably retired as a predatory teacher of sorts.
In my case, it was actually normalized. Most of the cool teachers that everybody liked in school partook.
Yeah.
There was Mr. Sufi, there was Mr. Nate, there was the math teacher.
They were all doing stuff.
And they were pretty, everybody loved them.
Exactly.
Everybody loved
them.
With the way they dress, the way they treat you in school, and all of that. Everybody loved them.
And you know, the annoying thing is that it has been normalized so much that we even have a proverb for it. Like the fancies say, "One who will be a onion, a kutukraba, or a ketro."
Catch them young.
catch them young. And then there's Titi Kule. And then there was this other one that he who grounds granite is allowed to lick his fingers. I'm finding it difficult to say it in Chi, because it's a Chi proverb that the person who grounds the granite is allowed to lick their fingers. So, everybody eats from where they work.
We understood that in the context of
religion. Yes, but in this case, that's how it applied. So it's quite troubling, and again, it's made memories of primary school always traumatizing. Even though primary school was when my love for science, my love for poetry, my love for words come from, but then again, I look back and I remember all these things that scarred us.
Then again, people will be like, the Africans, what you might scar, get over it. Until it happens to you, then you realize talking to someone or help actually works. You never would understand that you actually sometimes need to talk to somebody about some of the things that's happened to you. I have a couple of things in this head that I have never actually opened up to someone about, and I'm hoping I'll get that opportunity. It will make me better as a person. It would make me better. I can't wait, actually.
Alright, we'll take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll look at life in senior high. I mean, we were in the same senior high, so...
Same house, actually.
Same house, yeah. So I'm sure we'll share similar stories.
This is the Hacktivist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Hacktivist Podcast.
And we are back. So, before we left, we were talking about life in primary and recollecting our traumatic
experiences
with pedophilia in primary
normalized school. Pedophilia.
Normalized pedophilia in primary school. Moving on to senior high, we both went to Adisadal College. Adisadal College, how did that experience influence
you? Best time of my life.
I know.
It was the best time of my life, man. I was at my lowest and I was at my highest. I went on stage and was celebrated, chanting, there's something about that actually. Mm-hmm. So I understand these artists.
Yeah.
It's and I discovered writing in Addis Adel, and it blew my mind. The fact that you could actually write a verse killed me. Anyway, so Addis school was great. It was awesome from form one throughout to form two, form three. It was one of the best experiences in my life ever. So, yeah, I got my friends for life. Mm-hmm. Friends for life. I realized homosexuality was actually a thing. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, people were actually gays. Mm-hmm. And they actually engaged in sexual activity. Mm-hmm. Actually found that out, and not accepted, but found that out in secondary school. Like, people could actually be gay and engage in gay sex and enjoy it freely, not rape or pedophilia or anything of that sort, but amongst themselves. I found that out in a disco, and I was celebrated in a disco. I was a bad guy in a disco. My name was known for being bad and all of that. Yeah, so it was great. It was awesome. I got suspended indefinitely a couple of weeks before SHS.
I remember.
Yeah, before our final exams.
I remember.
Yes, well, yeah.
You were just living your life.
Charlie. Yeah, it was
I awesome. Don't know why. You see, the thing about senior high and schools in general in Ghana is they don't realize that being an adolescent is a time of questioning, of trying to find yourself, and because of that, adolescents, there's a way you should treat adolescents. Like, they try and force their ways on us, and that easily makes us rebel, and we either rebel obviously or rebel in ways that are not so obvious, so you may rebel by breaking schools or because really nobody told us why there were those rules. Like, there was no discussions. It was just, hey, these are the rules, obey them. Like, why? Take for instance the grass thing in senior high. What does it even mean? Don't step on the grass. Where else are we going to step? Like, it makes no sense.
Well, they wanted to keep the aesthetics of the school, so yeah.
So speak to us.
Yes.
So speak to us about that. Create footpaths for us, but there's nothing. It's just opening.
Or let us imbibe into the reason why you want us to.
Exactly. Let us buy into that idea. Okay. Even you can find ways of getting across to us, like, oh, who has the greenest lawns? Let the school be up. Yeah, but then nothing like that. Just, hey, these are the rules. Hey, we have complaint at this time. Hey, you have to study at this time. Like,
even that awesome bell, we couldn't throw it.
Which one?
The bell.
Yeah.
If you are caught.
It didn't make any sense. And I feel like that's why a lot of the time adolescents rebel. Because to the adults, it's easier to just give them instructions rather than just talk to us. No one really was talking to us back then, were they? No one was trying to have a conversation with us. And then again, the environment in uni, I felt like, did we even have a counselor?
I never knew we had a guidance and counseling center until level 400. And the thing with
did?
Yeah,
in Addis Ababa. In uni. But in senior high, did we?
No, we didn't.
So we didn't have anybody to talk to.
Who do you think would have been our guidance and counseling officer? And the thing with rebellion
is that looking back,
sometimes we rebel to make us feel relevant.
Yes.
To make us feel like, yes, we are known. Because it felt better to me to be known, to be popular, or to be recognized for something. That is skewed towards rebellion. So you have me not going for preps, and I feel G because I feel those who go for prep are sissies, or those who go for school functions are stuck up people, quote unquote geeks who don't know. I mean, you can be smart and also be, but I mean, for you to obey every time, I feel like
you're basically a penguin in line. You know? Yeah, that's it.
So I did some of the things I did in school to feel relevant. So I got introduced to lots of things. I got introduced to music. I got introduced to writing. I got introduced to read also in secondary school. I got introduced to sex in secondary school. I got introduced to lots of things in secondary school, and I enjoyed all of them amazingly. And looking back, most of the things I have in my life now, or most of the notions I have in my life now, most of them were formed, or they became cemented in secondary school. For instance, my love for music, or the type of music I listened to, in secondary school, or that I loved in secondary, even in secondary, I used to love jazz. Just that because of the things I did, I never got to listen to jazz, but I loved jazz. I loved live music. I loved rap music. I loved reggae music. High life, well, not necessarily in secondary school, but music and writing also in secondary school. I found out I could write a verse and probably get together with a couple of people and do a song. Oh my God, it blew my mind. I listened to reggae music a lot in secondary school and underground rap music. And you know, most of the things they talk about are empowerment, black people, the government, the ills of the government, conspiracy theories.
Again, all about rebellion.
Yes, and that's the kind of music I listen to. And looking back, I still listen to the same kind of music, even the same kind of artist I used to listen to then, now. And I'm excited when I listen to that kind of music now. You find me texting someone I knew in secondary school and say, "Chuck, do you remember this album? I'm currently listening to it now." And the person will be like, "Yeah, we'll vibe to that." And it's all in the, it all goes with rebellion. We want to feel relevant because we feel like at least we have to. There's nothing, the system isn't right. I got introduced to that in secondary school.
The system isn't right. It's broken.
We have to. We can't just we cannot just be statistics. We have to count.
Mm-hmm.
So I got introduced to that in secondary school, and that formed most of the things I do
mm-hmm.
currently.
Good.
Yeah.
Last thing about secondary school. Did anyone inspire you apart from our mates? Apart from our seniors, mm-hmm. did anyone inspire any personality inspire you? Who was the most to you the most influential figure?
Well, the first thing, I may be wrong, but the first thing that comes up my mind is the kind of music I listen to.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Immortal Technique, have you?
Yeah.
Yes. I got introduced to him in secondary school. Sizzla Kalonji,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have. I got introduced
Sizzla,
to him in secondary school, and I follow these guys till date. I've been to a Sizzla concert. I've connected with Technique on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Sizzla was actually supposed to come down to Ghana a couple of months ago, but mm-hmm. the organization didn't go too well. So, yeah, so I would readily, from the top of my head,
mm-hmm.
I would identify the kind of artist I listen to, because they formed my
mm-hmm.
perceptions
about the world and everything.
They formed my perception about the world,
mm-hmm.
about inequality, about the downtrodden, about politicians,
mm-hmm.
about governments,
mm-hmm.
about conspiracy
mm-hmm.
theories and all of that. So
mm-hmm.
I would say, because it helped get me
mm-hmm.
out into that kind of life or into
yeah.
that kind of perception, they were my superheroes. I mean, if anywhere you mention Technique,
mm-hmm.
I listen to other artists, Wu-Tang kind of person,
yeah.
but Technique was pure. I mean, his first two albums, Revolutionary Volume 1, Revolutionary Volume 2, even the name itself,
yeah.
and the kind of things he spoke about. He introduced me to the war on drugs,
mm-hmm.
or how weed became illegal, how the government gets involved in drug trafficking
mm-hmm.
and all of that, profiling, police brutality,
mm-hmm.
and all of that. So it opened my eyes to a lot of things.
That was
reggae music also. Sorry to cut
yeah.
you. Also introduced me to, made me appreciate nature and
mm-hmm.
simplicity
mm-hmm.
and the black woman. I would say it's the
yeah.
black woman.
Yeah.
So that aspect of it also. At a point in my life, actually, I embraced Rastafari, quote
yeah.
unquote. I embraced Rastafari. I started growing my hair, started hailing
mm-hmm.
Emperor Haile Selassie, Pan-Africanism
yeah.
and all of that. I still have some of those views,
mm-hmm.
Pan-Africanism and all, but I dropped some of them also
yeah.
because I grew up.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I grew up. So I would say with role models, I'll go back to the music I listen to.
And interestingly enough, that was because hip hop was born out of a revolution.
Reggae
also born out of
yes.
a revolution.
Yes.
So what you consider rebellion, or what you consider you being bad,
mm-hmm.
was actually you just partaking in a revolution. You just tapping into the revolution is all around us. It's in the ether around us. Because you feel the frustrations, and then you have to find an outlet for it. And hip hop and rap
reggae.
Music and reggae had always been that voice that, you know, provides the soundtrack to the revolution.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it's a perfectly logical answer for what inspired you, because that also inspired me. But I was also more inspired by words. Because me, I'm inspired by words in general, whether they are in song or in writing. So some revolutionary poets, my love for women.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of my favorite poems is Phenomenal Woman, Maya Angelou. And then the oldies. So I Anyi Dawo has some great revolutionary stuff. What's his name? The guy who wrote The Cathedral.
Yeah, who died.
Yeah.
So
so I always go back to the words, like the way they put the words together.
Atukwe.
So the way they put the words together, sometimes it almost seems spiritual. Like it's targeting you. It's like it feels like they wrote it for you, and that it's supposed to be you who is doing it.
I got the same vibe from listening to music. Sometimes I would be listening to an album or a track of someone, and the person would, let's say, give a 6-liner, and I have to pause and just absorb what the person actually said, and actually allow myself to be in awe.
Yeah.
How the person was able to conceptualize this, put it in word or prose, and make it rhyme to the beat.
Yeah.
That is something I mean I've written and have before, but to date, the way people are able to express themselves in song, especially in rap music, because it's personally, I think it's easier to write a song than to write good rap music, because you have to do more.
Yeah. You have to tell a story and then make it rhyme. And then also make sure that it's in a particular rhythm, a particular set
and
time.
And then not sell out.
Obviously.
Because lots of people do it, but they end up, selling out is relative, but they end up doing it to suit the crowd. That's what I mean by selling out. I mean, Manifest has lived abroad several times, several years. He could decide to slur, but I've followed his music since uni.
He doesn't.
He's never slurred a moment. The only song I heard him ever try to slur was on a Free Chikata song for a Free Chikata movement I was part of in uni with Kwesi Pat and Co. That's it. Even though it wasn't full slurring, it was just a semblance of it, because I think he was still doing his master's thing.
Yeah.
This is the Hacktivist Podcast.
Welcome back. So you've been listening to the Hacktivist Podcast. I'm here with Ejari, and we had talked about senior high life. Let's move on to uni. You went to Legon.
Unfortunately.
Yes. Why do you say that?
Legon isn't a progressive institution, I think.
Okay.
Yes. Back then it was, but currently it's just a place to indulge. That's why I say unfortunately. There are other campuses that encourage reading, encourage academic, even at your first degree level, encourage individualism, but Legon mostly encourages you to follow or be engaged in groupthink. You go for the parties, you do whatever your peers are doing, and then you get a good grade and you go out to get a job.
I think most campuses, again, that from my experience, right, KNUSD was kind of similar,
but most people came from other places.
It wasn't the same. I'm grateful.
But Legon, we are in Accra. Most people are in Accra. They come from Accra. They know all the places. They can go make moves, get money, do whatever they have to do. So it makes it more difficult.
I'm grateful for what tech offered me, because a lot of my free thinking, even though it was developed in Adesada College, a lot of them also stem from the fact that KNUSD offered more diversity, like in terms of exposure, in terms of the extent of the diversity, you get it. So I met more religions, people of more diverse religions, because of the science aspect, people were coming from.
You were pretty much engulfed in that aspect of life already.
Yes.
Before you entered.
Before I entered uni, I was already like this geek nerd kind of person, but then KNUSD offered me the opportunity to be more of me. So,
would you allow me to interview you one of these days?
Obviously, yes.
I would like to do that. I have lots of questions in my head. That's just by the way.
I would love that. So, you don't feel Legon offered any input into your...
Never, ever. Even with the kind of courses I took, first of all, I wanted to major in philosophy, but my mom, she said, no, philosophy is for people who have gone mad, people don't watch TV, and I don't watch TV now. So I don't know what she wanted to prevent. So she said philosophy was for people who have gone mad, people who don't watch TV.
How many philosophers has she met?
People who have gone off track with respect to society, or there's no wow. societal gain. So my mom is not an academic. So she I had to diverge. I loved philosophy, but I couldn't. So I had to. I ended up majoring in sociology.
Okay.
Which was cool. Because I got it easily.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much close to philosophy. Yeah. It's the closest you can get to philosophy. Yeah.
So. But sociology is kind of. Well, let me just hold it. So uni was cool. I enjoyed SHS, mm-hmm. Secondary school more than uni.
Mm-hmm.
But uni was cool. But in uni, I found myself.
Mm-hmm.
In SHS, I was looking through several shelves, looking for who I was.
Yeah.
And in uni, I think I found myself. So in uni, I actually went on a celibacy thing
mm-hmm.
for a couple of years. I read a lot of things outside my course that I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
I found individuality attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked out for the ladies who didn't engage in the things that everyone was doing,
mm-hmm.
and in my head found them attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But I never could walk up to them.
Yeah.
So in uni, I became stable in the kind of things I believed
mm-hmm.
to usher me into the next phase of my life, i.e. after uni.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened in uni. I met a couple of friends, but not really friends, because up to now I don't engage them, but I do engage my friends from my district or college.
From senior high, yeah.
Yes, I do engage them. But in uni, I don't engage them much. No, I don't think so.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's about it.
Okay.
Uni was cool. Though I remember an experience. I majored in sociology. I majored, so I did my thesis was on the effects of religion on academic life.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this interest from way back.
Yeah.
I wanted to understand how religiosity affected people's academic life, whether it made you better academically or retrogressed to academic progress. And from all the studies I had looked at, because religion stepped out to improve the personal ethic of the follower, it ended up making the follower's life better. Also the academic life, because they are setting ethics in religion, religiosity, regardless of the kind of religion you are following. That encouraged you to be best at what you are doing, but it still demanded your individuality, to make
so
it
you
work.
Sacrifice your individuality out there,
So, people who engage in more religiosity ended up doing better academically.
Yeah.
That was the conclusion of the research I did based on the somehow or somewhat scientific research I did, because I interviewed over almost 300 people out of the sample size in Lagos.
Yeah.
I interviewed almost 300 people, and from their experiences or from what they shared.
So it was a self-reported kind of study, because most sociological studies are self-reported. So you have surveys and stuff.
So you do the survey, you come, you analyze it, and then you present it for your degree.
Yeah.
FYI. My supervisor, who was a reverend father, didn't believe I actually did that. He asked me whether I did this myself, and I said, yeah, I did this. I was good with Google, so I was able to access certain information that people who were not as adept in using Google as I was. So I had lots of information.
Yeah.
So my questionnaires were on point.
Your references were
awesome.
Point, yeah.
So he couldn't believe I did that. So he asked me when I said yes. He said if I really did that, then I have a future in research. So I still believe, even though it's almost 15 years ago, that I do have, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I do believe I have a future in research. Because even now in the office, if anyone needs any information from Google, they come to me. So I believe I have a way of finding information. Yes, free information.
Which, then again, I'll ask your opinion about whether...
Because we're using G-Store. But analyzing information on G-Store demanded a lot. Because you need to read everything the guy said, or his research, and then make your own conclusion. Yeah. That is too much.
It's too much work. That's one of the drawbacks of what I consider graduates, the typical graduate work. That's one of the reasons why I'm not so interested in graduate work. But then that's a story for another day.
Another day, straight.
Okay,
straight.
So we're looking at uni.
And I formed my conception about women also in uni.
Okay.
Because I got to understand from my experience with listening to reggae music and hip-hop music, I got to realize the fact that women have been undertrodden over throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to appreciate the woman more to the extent that I didn't even want to. Because in uni, that's when we have sex most.
Yeah.
I didn't even want to have sex with a woman. Mm-hmm. For just the sake of having sex, because I saw sex as a quote-unquote as a spiritual exercise, and it was so deep that I needed to be in sync with the lady before I actually had sex with the lady. So I went on a celibate. I was celibate for a couple of years, like 2 years minimum, from level 200 ending throughout my stay in uni. So it formed my, I had certain preconceived notions, but it cemented my notions about women in uni. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about your belief in God, since your thesis was about how that affected you.
And during that period, not to cut you, during that period, I sought out to look for God. During that, because it was my last year in uni, so I sought out to look for God. So I read lots of texts.
And did you find her?
And I set out to be a strict devote of the Christian faith. Notion of God. So you have me, and because I was a Pan-Africanist and I had come from a Rastafari background, because I told you I had that that thing in secondary school when I listened to reggae music, so it's kind of optioned me to Rastafari. So I kind of had that notion. So I had a personal conception about God. That's where my individuality came from. I had a personal conception about God. I was following the Christian God, but I still had my personal conception about who God was and what or who he or she is supposed to be. But then again, it wasn't sinking.
Yeah, it didn't make sense, really.
Yes, because what I believed didn't match with the Christian
God
perception of who God was. So you find me fasting on every other Saturday, looking for the face of God, trying to pray, trying to forcefully speak in tongues, but really forcing myself to say blah blah blah, and then accepting to myself that didn't make sense. So just pray, just step out, think about God in vague, think about the beauty of God in vague, think about the awesomeness of God in vague. But the only thing that stuck with me was how grateful I was for the kind of life I was living. In all of this, I could do lots of things. I could hold lots of opinions about who God was, about what God is, about what people think who God was. But the only thing I took out of that was that I was very grateful for the kind of life I have. So that fed into the kind of notion I have now. What I believe now, I don't know if it's right for me to bring it out now, is that, well, I'm some sort of an agnostic. I don't know, and I'm glad not to know. I don't know, but the fact that I don't know doesn't mean I have to accept what you believe.
Yeah,
that makes me an agnostic. But I also believe that as a human being, the kind of things I experience with sleep, with daydreaming, with wishing for kind of society I wish to come to fruition or to come to existence.
Yeah.
I feel like there has to be something more. So if someone, I say I'm a progressive agnostic, because I know there is, or I believe there has to be something more than I see now. And I don't see much. I see what I see. There are several billions of people out there in the world. They see what they see, but I also see what I see. So what I believe is, I'm grateful.
Yeah.
So my religion is gratitude.
Gratitude.
Mm. I don't have anything. I don't know a God. Mm-hmm. I don't know who God is. I don't know who Satan is. Mm-hmm. I don't know who anyone is. All I know is I'm grateful. I wake up in the morning. I'm grateful for the life I have. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for the life my family has, my kids I have. I mean, I can wake up. I can smoke weed. I can drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. I can have sex. Mm-hmm. I can go out there and speak for people. Mm-hmm. I can give one CD out there to someone who doesn't have food to eat. Mm-hmm. I can speak to make someone happy. Mm-hmm. So in the morning when we are praying, mm-hmm. When they are praying, mm-hmm. in our morning meeting at work, I have to attend. Mm-hmm. My branch manager once openly spoke to me that why didn't I attend? So I have to attend because it's part of them. I have to.
Well, and this is it's a private company.
It's a private company.
And they have morning devotions.
Yes, every branch.
Okay.
So we have to go out there. But I go out there, I cross my fingers, I clap. This is what I do. I clap. I don't sing. Because mm-hmm. some of the things they sing,
it makes no sense.
Ludicrous.
Yeah.
I cannot sing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they sing like, "We thank you, Lord." I'll sing to that because mm-hmm. I'm grateful. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you think that Jesus love, I say fuck that shit. I don't know what that means. So there's no way I'm singing to that.
Yeah.
But things I can identify with, things that relate to me, mm-hmm. I will choose to identify with it. So that's the kind of life, or that's the kind of mindset or perception I hold currently. Mm-hmm. Purely gratitude.
Yeah.
Purely. I don't know anything else. I don't know no religion. I don't know any God. Unless you want me to say what I've heard. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe in things I revere mm-hmm. should be relegated to someone else's opinion.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. So
no religion be brand new. No
religion. I actually believe religion is a social club, so you can you can choose to identify with it.
No religion is a brand, actually.
No religion is a brand.
Yeah.
Unless that's what you choose to believe, but religion is actually a brand. It is.
No, but at the talk, if you brand, as in, like, I actually own a footwear that is no religion.
No, actually. Cute. That's true, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. I have a footwear that's
That's true. Anyway, so that's about it.
Okay. Can we talk about again? So now the label that I'm getting is agnostic.
Yes.
A progressive agnostic. Yes. Now you talk about,
I'm a feminist also, I believe. Okay. So yes, and then again I would give a scenario. Yesterday I had a t-shirt on that had "I met God." Mm-hmm. She was black. Mm-hmm. And I went to see a couple of people, friends of mine. We sat down, had a bottle of wine and kiddo with it. There was this lady, she's a casual staff there. She read what I had in my shirt. She couldn't fathom the fact that I thought God was a woman and that she was black. It was making her go crazy. So I told her that if there ever is a scientific inquiry that comes out to say that God is actually a woman and is black, she'll go mad. She actually accepted that. She said she'll actually go mad because she cannot think of a God who is a woman
or black
because God has to be a man
and white.
God has to be something that's super nice and awesome, obviously white, not black.
And she doesn't,
so she cannot fathom the fact that God can be a woman or God. So her case was peculiar. Her case was peculiar. I actually have lots of people who actually think like that amongst my colleagues, amongst my family. Mm-hmm. Whenever you raise these issues about the gender of God, they come up with all sorts of excuses and all of that. So, well, that's about it.
Okay, so I wanted to introduce the idea of more, because you mentioned that you think there should be more.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, will the idea of humanity itself be enough of a driving force of that more you are looking for? Because then again, you are grateful for the life that you have,
for everything, every experience
that you have. there are a lot of people.
Because it's humbling.
It's extremely humbling because yes. to even wake up every morning and then experience the things that we experience. I cannot imagine a time where, again, I cannot imagine a time where I was not born. Like, can I imagine?
Or you don't have, quote unquote, not, like, not living.
Yes. I cannot imagine not living. And I can also, so I cannot imagine a time not born. Neither can I imagine a time that I'll be dead. The only experience through which I can be grateful for, the only experience that I can be grateful for is being alive. So, will that not be something that ties us all together? Your religion of gratefulness,
gratitude.
It should, the religion of gratitude, it should be a universal thing that binds us all together to make sure that those who do not have as much as we do, we can make it such that they are also as grateful as we are.
The challenge herein is that most human beings don't have the kind of confidence to accept the, I'll use the word, blatant truth, because it's already in your face. Everything I say or I believe now is in everyone else's face, but most people choose to ignore. What they do is they are faced with so much and so many options that they just settle. So what we have is a breed or a race of sapiens who have settled. So regardless of what has happened, they just want the easiest way out. So okay, so let's see, Christianity, God created the world in 7 days. He sent his son Jesus Christ to come and save us. But that's just the easy way out, because it actually doesn't represent the actual case. So when human beings try to go the extra mile to look for, I don't want to use the word evidence, but to look for
the truth out there,
for themselves, at least for their own individual self, then they'll get to appreciate life and the life of the next person. And that's it, to realize their individuality. Once they realize their individuality and the fact that they matter, most scientists who are most scientists who are atheists like to believe that human beings are irrelevant. But I believe, so far as you can cause someone to laugh, then again, I'll go back to our morning meetings. When we pray, I say a prayer. I say that, oh Most High, please help me impact people today. Please help me make people smile. Please help me make people forget their troubles. Please help me come to into contact with people that, after they contact me or after my interaction with them, at least their pressures of life will be reduced to the barest minimum. So human beings are relevant. We are not irrelevant in this huge cosmos. I believe human beings, so far as you can make someone smile or so far as you can help someone come out of his current situation, we are relevant.
The truth is that, right? So the thing is, you're looking at two different frameworks, right? In the cosmic framework, right? No living being is relevant. In our day-to-day life, which is not cosmic, so human beings are extremely relevant. So what humanism teaches us is that we should look at our irrelevance and let that inspire us, so that no matter how big your ego gets. So it's an ego check, actually. So no matter how big you think you are, the cosmos thinks you are irrelevant.
It's amazing.
But then on this particular level, we are all the same. Because to the cosmos, there's no difference between man, woman, dog. To the cosmos, there's no difference between all of us.
We are just beings.
We are just there. But to us, it's a reminder to treat each other. Because the idea is that we are all in the same soup. We are all irrelevant to the cosmos.
Because in the interim, you can choose to matter.
Yes.
In the interim, whilst we are here, whilst we are searching for our daily bread, whilst people are suffering, whilst the people who are people who are people who are being downtrodden in the society, people who are being marginalized in the society, with you, they can matter.
Yes.
So you do matter.
Yeah.
At least now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the future.
Yeah.
But currently, I believe you do matter.
Yeah.
So far as you can cause someone to smile.
Yeah.
So far as you can give someone a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So far as you can cause someone to escape from his current
mm-hmm.
reality or from his current whatever he's experiencing.
Yeah.
We do matter. So
mm-hmm.
I do believe human beings matter.
Yeah.
And with that mattering,
mm-hmm.
we have the opportunity
to cause a difference, make a change.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And anytime I think about that, I'm humbled. I get goosebumps and I just relax and I breathe.
Because
it puts so much pressure on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, what am I doing? Who have I helped today? Whose troubles have I alleviated today?
Yeah.
Who have I made smile? Who have I made laugh?
Mm-hmm.
Who have I caused to do something positive today?
Mm-hmm.
So it goes.
I get how why you're emotional, because you've seen how important the little things matter and how much change you can bring by just doing so little. You may not know whether your hello and a smile has changed someone's life that particular day, because they may have felt unloved or unimportant, and just your hello may have lighted up their day. Yeah. So I get why you feel so passionate about this. I want to interrogate your growth, because we spoke about
secondary
school. Heteropedophilia.
Yeah.
We spoke about
homosexuality. For someone who went through the whole Rastafarian
mm-hmm.
phase, there's something about Rastafarians and homosexuality.
Yeah.
That we feel, or they feel, no, not we, because I do not identify as a Rasta now,
yeah.
but they feel homosexuality is a sin,
mm-hmm.
just as Christians feel,
because
Rastafarianism is engulfed in Christianity,
yeah.
so they feel homosexuality is a sin
mm-hmm.
that comes from hell,
yeah.
that is from Satan,
mm-hmm.
I don't know where Satan is from, but it's from Satan, so it should... We should fight against it, and that the whole world is out there to get homosexuality legalized and
yeah.
accepted as and normalized.
Yeah.
So we should go out there and fight against the bomber clad party
yeah,
system.
Yeah,
yeah, we even see the system as a whole party system.
Yeah.
And party here, it means homosexuality.
Yeah.
So we see the whole system as a party system. So the whole system is a homosexual system.
Yeah.
That's how
yeah.
it was. Looking back from secondary school, kids or boys who used to display homosexual tendencies or feminine tendencies, I remember myself, we used to go out there, whenever we see them, we yelled at them, "Batty boy."
Yeah, yeah.
Batty boy is Jamaican for
homosexual.
Stupid homosexual
yeah.
or derogatory homosexual.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we used to go, batty boy, oh, batty boy, chop
yeah,
ass. So we used to do that. And currently, when I think about that, then again, I'm humbled, because it was a very ignorant thing that I used to do.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone that I did that to, I'm sorry. It was ignorant of me. I'm a better person now. I wish you all the best in your life. But homosexuality then, what I saw now with the kind of religiosity I engulfed myself in then and now, it's a whole 180
mm-hmm.
that I have been through. Now I see myself as an activist
mm-hmm.
for homosexuals or for gay rights
mm-hmm.
than what I used to do
mm-hmm.
as an activist for gays to be jailed and
yeah.
brutalized and all of that. I believe then that violence to them was
justified.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so it was terrible then, but I'm grateful for the fact that I've seen the kind of things I've seen, to accept the kind of things I accept But that was what I went through. It was a whole cognitive dissonance that I felt like then homosexuals were, I don't even know the kind of words to describe them. Mm-hmm. There was no words to describe them. They were just like devils.
Yeah.
Then, but now I accept and I know that they are just as human as I am. And they want to feel and explore their sexuality like how I feel and explore my sexuality. So, yeah, that's one.
Mm-hmm.
That's just homosexuality. And you can imagine the kind of tendencies I had, or the kind of notions I had then as compared to now. So when it comes to women's rights, even though I respected women, I felt like they should be behind men.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they should be behind men because they are women. Mm-hmm. As per what the Bible says, because I believe the Bible to be true in with respect to whatever it says, regardless of whatever I thought or whoever thought. So women were I respect them and all, the black women and all, but yeah,
they should still be behind men.
They should still be behind men. Whatever the society does to them, it's a man who can actively put in the work for them to be accepted. But now it's a whole different I've gone a whole 360 or a whole 180.
Yeah.
Cause what I believe then, I believe homosexuals are part of us, and I thought with colonialism that homosexuality was alien to us. As in black people, homosexuality was alien to us.
Yeah.
It was a white who introduced homosexuals or homosexuality to us. From Greek mythology to all of that, it was a white who brought it to us. I'm finding out more things that I ever thought. I actually read an article yesterday about how homosexuality was normalized pre-colonial period.
So with knowledge, you're changing your opinion based on new information.
Straight. And that's my challenge with religiosity or religions. They don't accept new information. And I find it difficult to accept why they don't accept it. Because they accept new information relating to anything else.
Except
their religion. So I don't get it.
Okay. But you may have more empathy for them when you again look at your past and how far you've been able to come.
At a point in time, actually, I became an ardent follower.
Mm-hmm.
I became a fasting every other Saturday, praying every morning for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, coming back, reading the Bible, meditating on the Bible, whatever that means, every single time, following the word, like for word to word.
Yeah.
At a point in time when I decided to go out in search for God.
Mm-hmm.
Actually went out in search for God.
Mm-hmm.
I went to religion first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to alternate religion, i.e. Asian religion, Rastafarianism, and people who have some semblance of Christianity in there, but not actual Christianity.
Yeah.
So I went out there looking for all of that. So I actually followed ardently. I followed. I prayed. I actually tried to even speak in tongues. So I would pray several times, encouraging myself to say something that is not as if it were. So I went there and say, I'll pray, hoping that all these things I'm saying will end up being tongues. I'll pray, God is going to be, hoping it will end up being in tongues, but nothing like that came out. So I realized then and then that let me just follow my own version of Christianity. So I ended up with a vague term known as Christafarianism. There was actually a band called Christafari. It was a reggae band following Rastafarianism, but singing songs about Jesus and all
gospel,
of that gospel reggae.
Gospel reggae. Okay.
So I ended up following things like that and realized, well, it was never the same.
Yeah.
It wasn't the same. It was all trying not to accept myself as who I am, my flaws. Because what I was doing all then was trying to mask my flaws or trying not to accept my flaws and make up some sort of excuse for it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I realized who I was, realize these are my flaws, and realize that I actually can gain strength from identifying them as flaws and being comfortable with them as my flaws, I gain strength over them. I realize that, yo, it's all in my mind. I can actually have power over all these things when I just empower my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I gradually started taking myself out of that religious context until I got to this place. Yeah, I'm on a journey. Mm-hmm. I'm on a great journey. It's been awesome. I have a wife who is pure Christian. She attends Otago Girls Church, unfortunately.
unfortunately.
With my kids, so they go to church every other Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep telling my little girl, my eldest girl, who is turning five in December, to come to me and tell me to go to church. Yes,
trying every to play time. The daddy-daughter card.
Yeah, but I mean, they know I'm smarter than that.
Yeah.
So now they are being careful because gradually I'm empowering my little girl.
Okay.
So they are being extra careful.
That's good to know.
Yeah, I'm empowering her. I am. So I always wanted a girl for my first.
Because
it means I have to put in more work for her to be accepted as with relation to who a man would have been. So I always wanted a first. I always wanted a daughter to be my first child. So I knew, well, you could say it's prophecy, but I knew my first girl would be a girl.
Mm-hmm.
My first child would be a girl. And I knew the kind of name she would get before all of that happened. So yeah, I named my daughter Africa with a cape.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm trying to empower her as a woman to step out and be whoever she wants to be.
Yeah.
I'm actively putting in that work. Because if my first child was
a guy,
it would have been, let me say, easier, because society would have aged.
Society is already,
So the fact that I wanted a girl to be first, and the fact that I wanted to empower her, it's more work for me, and I love more work.
Yeah.
Especially if it's revolutionary.
Yeah.
So that's
if we are not going to, again, speaking to how even your idea of you being bad in school was actually you being revolutionary, you being anti-establishment. If we are not going to see the revolution in our lifetime, at least our kids should be equipped enough,
aware,
you know, to get the job done. If you couldn't cut the head off the serpent.
There's a song by one of my best hip hop groups, not to cut you.
Yeah.
They're called the Grave Diggers.
Yeah.
The title of the song is The Pit, and it talks about the fact that we are all in a pit of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the first step is to realize that you are in a pit of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
In a pit of snakes, and that you need to take yourself out of the pit. And the only way you can take yourself out of that pit of snake is to chop off the head of the snake. So it goes like, awake and chop the heads off these snakes. It's better off than dying in a pit full of snakes.
Yeah.
The snake inside yourself should be the first head to take.
Exactly.
It's better off than dying in a pit full of snakes.
That's pretty revolutionary.
So that's you know, there's something about hip hop that the world hasn't realized.
This is what the world hasn't realized, though. You know, this is the thing. Revolutions, right? The established status quo knows the tools of the revolution and actively fights against the tools of the revolution. You see how hip hop has been demonized?
Yeah.
It's because they understand how effective hip hop is as a tool for the revolution. That's why, and again, that's why hip hop, to me, I feel like it has been co-opted and commercialized to the point where the tools, like what it was supposed to do, the revolution was supposed to lead, there are elements now in hip hop culture that is anti the revolution, which is denigrating women, which
promoting
is
drugs,
promoting drug
promoting,
use, promoting not saving, like just
spending
unnecessary spending. like promoting capitalism,
all of that,
promoting
promoting hoarding,
yes,
hoarding, promote,
exactly,
hoarding for yourself and not helping,
not helping people, yeah, so
promoting not giving people second chances,
exactly, and all of that is a co-option by the established status quo, because they understand how powerful art in general is, because the revolution in itself, right, it's all about it. Art is what is going to win the revolution, because
and
the revolution
will never be televised.
It will not be televised. The revolution will be fought in the heart of man, and what speaks to the heart of man if not art? Mm-hmm. Right? Or if you look at how a people, a community is changed, if you look at how we became believers as Africans became believers, right? They took our art and give us their art. They took our words and gave us their words.
Took our names.
Yes.
And gave us their
so
names.
It's all about co-opting and then reinforcing so that people forget
who they were.
Who they were.
And imbibe new identities,
yes,
that they don't even know about.
Exactly. Exactly. It's been extremely fun speaking to you, Ejari. We've gone through your evolution as a person. And we've touched on a lot of topics, and hopefully we can have a chat another time when you're around. Any
awesome
last words?
Well, for everyone who listens, who is a religious person, I would request that you ask questions. I mean, there's nothing wrong. People feel like there's something wrong with questioning the status quo. Especially when it comes to religiosity or religion, there's nothing wrong with asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's totally fine to ask or to doubt whatever you have been
mm-hmm.
taught from infancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a living testimony. I believe so many things that now, with new evidence, with new knowledge, with new experiences,
mm-hmm.
I've done a whole 360 or a 180.
Mm-hmm.
I have done a 180.
Yeah.
So, I urge people to ask questions, to feel comfortable
mm-hmm.
doubting what they have been taught,
mm-hmm.
because that's where freedom comes from.
Yeah.
If you don't doubt what you have been taught from infancy, or what you have been taught to believe,
mm-hmm.
there can never be freedom. There can never be freedom.
Yeah. And on that note, I just want to conclude with this. There's an interesting article by Dr. Leo Igwe, is a humanist friend of ours, where he asks us to install the iDoubt software. Where he asks us to install the iDoubt software in us, because doubting is good. We have not realized this, but every good thing we love now is because somebody asked questions, somebody doubted.
I'm clapping to that.
All right. Thank you for listening, and then see you next time. Bye.
This has been the Hacktivist Podcast. As always, think for yourself and care for others.
You can find the Hacktivist Podcast on SoundCloud. Follow us on Facebook at Hacktivist. The Hacktivist Podcast is brought to you by the Humanist Association of Ghana. Find out more on www.ghanahumanists.org.